Committee hold will come to order. Privilege of the floor, Representative Lindholm. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Privilege of the floor. Members of the 63rd, I'd like to introduce you to my daughter, who's the page for the last half of the day, Willow Ann, right here, and her little brother, Caleb, is right up there. Willow is in the third grade, and Caleb is going into kindergarten next year, so we got exciting times ahead of us, and if you'd welcome to the floor, I'd appreciate it.
Welcome, Caleb. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 231. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 231 from Representative Baker, an act relating to Hathaway Scholarship Program, modifying eligibility requirements as specified, providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, to Committee Number 4, Education, to whom is referred House Bill 231, Hathaway Scholarships-Exemptions from Requirements, respectfully report same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with following amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Freeman, Hunt, Yagi, Northrup, Patton, Paxton, Piperinen, Summers, and Throne. Signed by Representative Patton, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Patton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 231 do pass and yield the floor to its prime sponsor.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is a standing committee amendment, so at this time I'll move standing committee amendment number 1 to House Bill 231 and ask for your favorable consideration. It's just a cleanup amendment, so at this time, if there are no questions, it's germane to the intent of the bill and I think clarifies the intent. At this time, if there are no questions, I'll ask for the question on the standing committee amendment.
Any question? All in favor of standing committee amendment number 1, please say aye. Opposed, no. Motion carried. Proceed, Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the body, this was dispersed, this handout here. It's 4 boxes discussing the Hathaway Scholarship. It was just before lunch, so it's probably 6 or 7papers down. If you want to grab that, that'll kind of alleviate some of the concerns I think that people may have with this bill. So this bill is... has to do with the Hathaway Scholarship. It's not going to change the qualifications. That's what the handout illustrates here. So the one thing that we're going to be dealing with is on the handout, you'll see a rectangle on the right-hand side of all of the all 4 boxes that says, quote, cannot initiate prior to natural graduation date. So this bill is basically going to allow those individuals that are moving forward with their life and with the Hathaway and the GED or HISET to basically have an automatic exemption to this clause. Currently under the laws, the way it works is an individual has to be either court-ordered to take the GED or HISET, or they have to show just cause to the department to apply for the Hathaway Scholarship prior to their natural graduation date. So the bill is going to create two automatic exemptions for individuals that have either been emancipated by the court or become a parent or legal guardian to another minor. So for me, I think it's a good bill. It came about with my wife is actually works for the county nursing, and she works a lot with Healthy Moms, Healthy Babies. And in Rock Springs, we have over 30 pregnant females in our high school. We're second only to another county in the state. So we have a lot of these individuals in our area. So if there are no questions, I'll call for the question on the bill.
Okay. Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Patton's motion when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 231 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill. House House Bill 231 is passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 208. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 208 from Representative Burkhart, an act relating to game and fish, limiting issuance of resident deer and resident elk licenses as specified, providing exceptions, providing for rulemaking, requiring maintenance of records, specifying fees, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom is referred House Bill 208, hard-to-draw hunting licenses, respectfully report saying back to the House with a recommendation that are due pass for the following amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Klim, Freeman, Kirkbride, Larson, Petroff, Steinmetz. Those who voted no, Representatives Baldwin and Barlow. One excused, Representative Schwartz, signed by Representative Petroff, Chairman.
Okay, you've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Petroff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 208 do pass. I further move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. And what this does, so the bill has some rather complicated computer aspects to it that will need to happen. And so the committee wanted to change the effective date to January 1st, 2016. Just to be sure to indicate that it was not going to happen by this hunting season. Unfortunately, I don't know if you remember how last Friday was, and it was that way for our committee as well. So it takes us a standing committee amendment as well as a committee of the whole amendment to accomplish that. So I encourage your idle on the standing committee amendment, and then we have a committee of the whole amendment following that will actually be the correct date.
Everybody understand the standing committee amendment? You ready to vote? All in favor of standing committee amendment number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing committee amendment number 1 has been adopted. We're back on the bill.
And, Mr. Chairman, if I may also move at this time committee of the whole amendment number 1, which, so now we're at July of 2016. Now we want to take it to January of 2016. So if I could encourage your aye vote on the committee of the whole amendment.
Everybody understand the Committee of the Whole Amendment? All in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1, please say aye. Opposed, no. Motion carried.
Okay, and I turn the explanation of the bill over to Representative Burkhart.
Representative Burkhart, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 208 is a bill concerning hunting license. And that over the years, hunting in Wyoming has changed somewhat as it has everywhere in the country, and there are a variety of reasons for that. But part of the thing is everyone wants that really nice animal to hang on the wall. And it makes those licenses for those in high demand. In our random drawing for those licenses, for the limited quota license in those really desirable areas, you get one chance a season. That's it. If you don't draw, well, you're out of luck. And some of these areas have very, very high demand. The bill increases a resident's chance of drawing one of those licenses, and at the same time doesn't remove the hunting opportunities they have for the remainder of even that year or others. It's, you know, unlike a point system that you have to build up so many points, this is not a point system in any way, shape, or form. It maintains and improves a young hunter's chances, and that by controlling the number of applicants in these hard-to-draw areas, and that's what this bill talks about. The bill establishes hard-to-draw licenses and hard-to-draw areas, and these are areas that are in high demand for a variety of reasons. One, the quality of the animals coming out of those areas. The other, a lot of these areas are very close to our more populated areas and are more convenient to hunt in. The bill talks about and defines a hard-to-draw area, meaning a hunting area by area and type of license. And those of you who are familiar, our license types have numbers to them. And generally a type 1 is for bull elk or buck deer, and then you can go on to antlerless license and those things. But it's the type 1s that are in high demand. And what the bill does is controls and talks about hard-to-hunt areas defined as those areas that have a success rate in the drawing of 10% or less. On the elk side, and in your inbox is a handout marked House Bill 208 at the top, and it's a chart and shows some of these areas for elk and deer. And it covers, this bill covers only those areas that have that 10% or less success rate. So what happens is, if you draw one of those licenses for that, these highly coveted ones or hard to draw areas, you are restricted to not being able to apply for those for 5 years. You can apply in any other area. You can buy a general license. It's just you cannot hunt in a defined hard to draw hunting area by hunt area and type. Those areas are determined from the previous year's random drawing success rate. And that's what that table shows you is what they were for a number of areas in 2014, 2013, 2012, 2011. And it will vary somewhat by year to year. As the demand goes down, the success rate will go up. If the demand goes up, the success rate goes down. And it tends to be in that way self-limiting. And self-regulating, and helps with herd numbers and the herd approach that the Game and Fish takes, the department takes, in controlling the animals. And it can move above or below that 10% cutoff, and it will vary from year to year. Now, on the maps, it's easier just to look at them. The cross-hatched areas are the areas that are currently would be considered hard to draw, and those will vary from year to year. That's kind of the bill in a nutshell. They are mutually exclusive. You apply separately for both, and it's handled for both. So if you get a deer in a hard to draw area, you can still get an elk in a hard to draw area, and if you are removed for 5 years from one, you are not removed for the other one. And that's it in a nutshell, and with that, I'll stand for questions.
Any questions or debate? Representative Barlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I have several questions. One, if 10% is the cutoff, why didn't we use 10 years as the restriction? Because then everybody would get the opportunity. And two, if you look at the information presented to you, let's just take, I guess I've got to use this. I've got to say hunt area 6 in the second graph, front page. In 2011, we were at 21%. Now we're at 9%. So what point does this hard-to-draw designation come? Is it every year and then it lasts for 7 years? What if we fluctuate between less than 10% and 21%? Because there's two things that go into the hard-to-draw issue, the number of applications and the quota. Neither of one does the hunter have any control over. Certainly they have the control over their single application, but they don't have control over the quota. That is set through agency regulation, and they don't have any application over how many people actually apply. Economics, lots of factors play into that. So ladies and gentlemen, while this I'm sure looks like a good idea, I think logistically it's challenging, and I think the challenge could probably be best seen on lines 20 and 21 of page 4, through rules and regulations. If we're going to do these rules and regulations every 5 years, possible. But if we're going to reevaluate this every year, it's going to be a yo-yo based on hunt and type, hunt area and type. Ladies and gentlemen, maybe a good concept, but I don't think this application is correct. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Those questions would be great about the 10% and then how this actually plays in the timing of both the setting of quotas and knowing you can actually go through the rulemaking process before the next application period. Thank you.
Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What the good representative said is true. The hunt areas will fluctuate. That was a question posed to the department. They tell me they will have no trouble doing this. They will announce and publish those hard-to-draw areas prior to the application period so that people have time to look at them. They tell me that they will not have difficulty identifying those people who did draw one so that they aren't in that hard-to-draw area pool for 5 years. So the agency has said, the department has said, that they can handle this without a lot of work. They'll make some changes in the computer system, and they already handle moose and sheep license, which once you get one, you can't apply for 5 years. So they're already doing it, and that's part of the idea for 5 years, was that it's already in their system. The other part is on the 10% number was a number, it could go up or down. I mean, you could make it some other number. These are the areas that are in really high demand, the desirable areas, and it was to help with the pressure on that those areas because we'll pull some people out of the pool. So,
Representative Laux?
Mr. Chairman, you have a question for the bringer of the bill, please. Actually, two questions. Why was antelope excluded? And then also, on the five-year delay, if you do draw a hard-to-get tag, which would be types 1, 2, and 9, I'm talking about elk specifically, then would you not be able to draw a type 3 or 4 tag for 5 years also?
Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The reason for antelope is antelope are currently all limited quota draw. And it was felt that if you put antelope in here, it would put a lot of pressure on some of these areas. There's an area I've hunted that several years ago, there were 900 licenses given out for that area. Today, there are 200 because of loss of habitat and some other things. And that was a reason for antelope. It just didn't fit well with antelope. On the others, the only license you're excluded from drawing for is a hard-to-draw license. For example, in some areas under this, the area and type 1 license have a success rate of, say, 5%. That same area may have a type 2 license that has a 40% success, and that's not included. You could still apply and receive one of those licenses. It's only those that have a 10% success by type and by area.
Representative Gay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question for the bringer of the bill is this. I'm using your handout here. If I apply for Deer Hunt Area 87 and draw that this year, does this bill preclude me from dropping down to another hard to draw area? Say if I drew 87 this year, I can't apply for 87, but can I apply for, say, 89 or one of the other hard to draw inside that five-year period?
Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, it would include all but only the hard-to-draw areas. For example, you could go into Area 86, Area 88 on the deer. Interesting thing is if you look at elk, Area 100 is ridiculously hard to draw with a 2.3% success. The two adjacent areas to that are not included because they have a success rate on the drawing on the lottery of greater than 10%, and that would be Area 24 and 118.
Any further debate? Okay. You ready for the question?
Call for the question.
The question has been called. All those in favor of Chairman Petroff's motion, though, when the committee of the whole rises to report it, do so with recommendation of House Bill number 208, do pass. Say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries. House Bill 208 is passed committee of the whole. Next bill for our consideration is...
Yeah, is that privilege?
Excuse me. Chairman Petroff.
Thank you. May I please have privilege, Mr. Chairman?
Proceed.
All right. So I'd like to introduce some folks in the gallery, but before I introduce them, I want everyone to To remind everyone that this week is the Governor's Conference on Travel and Tourism, and tonight is the reception at Little America. We hope you all will come. I want to announce the success that these folks in the gallery have had this year. We had this year a record-setting 10.1 million visitors to the state of Wyoming, which was an 11% increase over last year and a whopping 45% increase in the last decade. Thanks to the legislature for all of their support. That's been a big part of this success. So please help me welcome members of the travel and tourism industry from all across the state.
Welcome tourism to the House. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 216. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 216 from Representative Berger, an act relating to veterans, creating a new skilled nursing center for veterans and their spouses, providing for non-veterans to be admitted to the center if occupancy is below a certain level as specified, providing for administration and operation of the center as specified, authorizing the receipt and expenditure of funds as specified, establishing a fund requiring a report, providing rulemaking authority, authorizing a position, providing for recapture of the appropriation, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Security, Social Services. I need the security, folks. To whom is referred House Bill 216, Veterans Skilled Nursing Center, respectfully report saying back to the House with a recommendation that a due pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Baldwin, Barlow, Dayton, Edmonds, Harvey, Kasparik. Those who voted no, Representatives Larson, Schwartz, and Wilson. Further reviewed by your committee number 2, Appropriations, who respectfully report saying back to the House with a recommendation that a due pass with amendments. Those who voted aye, Representative Burkhardt, Conley, Greer, Harshman, Moniz, and Stepson. Those who voted no, Representative Nicholas, signed by Representative Harshman, Chairman.
Okay, you've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Harvey?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 216 do pass, and I will turn the explanation of the bill over to the Madam Majority Floor Leader, but first there is a standing committee from the Barber, Chairman Harshman.
Yeah. Chairman Harshman.
I thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do need to see the barber. And, Mr. Chairman, I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 216. And members, the Veterans Skilled Nursing Center is a concept that we've seen in the legislature before, and I think it's a very worthy concept. I think Committee Number 2 supports this concept, but our Standing Committee Amendment basically took the position and all the funding from the Omnibus Permanent Land Fund, the $3.5 million, from the bill. And the reason why really is, and you'll see in the budget when we discuss it on Wednesday and Thursday, and you've all have the study of our state health facilities around the state and including what to do with that facility in a small town north of here at the base of the Bighorns. We really think this concept will make it to the finish line in Wyoming when we do our big remodel of our facilities. But I just think this gets a little bit in front of what we're going to eventually have to decide this year and then particularly next year as we move forward to those facilities. So I would stand for any questions or discussion on the Standing Committee Amendment.
Any questions on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1? Ready for the question? All in favor of Standing Committee Amendment 1, say aye. Opposed, no. Standing Committee 1 has passed. Now we will. Majority Floor Leader Berger.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and as you can see, we did get quite the haircut in appropriations. But really, ladies and gentlemen, this is a work in progress, and I will be back tomorrow with a second reading amendment on looking at the possibility of a loan from the permanent land omnibus fund so that you can have a consideration of how we can move forward with the project if you find it favorable. You know, we started back in 2005 with the discussion of a veterans skilled nursing center. Wyoming is the only state that does not have a long-term care facility for our veterans. And with our veterans that are coming of age from the Vietnam War, we have more than 1,700 folks in the state of Wyoming that are going to be needing more care. This greenhouse living, which I gave you a copy of, just a few descriptions of what a skilled nursing center would look like. And by the way, I've had favorable consideration from both our labor committee and our appropriations committee on the concept. This is a new direction for the state of Wyoming. You can tell if you were to go back to reports and studies that we did in 2005 that you would find that veterans prefer to stay closer to home for long-term care. You would find that they would appreciate being in a more home-style type of a facility, a cottage, which this would be more like, 12 individuals probably to a unit, and not be in a institutional facility. You would find from the management audit that we had done in 2011 that we need nursing care facilities of this level in Wyoming. And in 2012, we did have legislation that narrowly failed by one vote. So you can see that we have had support and have had a strong interest in serving the veterans of Wyoming. Now in 2014, as it was stated earlier by our good chairman from appropriations, that we have had a recommendation in the interim report that a skilled nursing facility in our veterans home in Buffalo is recommended and will be needed most probably. And now it has assisted living there currently. It is a historic facility. It has been very well used and very popular around the state of Wyoming. And I foresee that we would have a greenhouse for living facility there in the future. I do not believe that by building and having the opportunity in northeastern Wyoming, in my facility where we now currently have cottages of the greenhouse living style operating and near our veterans hospital, that would preempt or discourage the future possibility there. The opportunity that we have here, ladies and gentlemen, is that we have the funding capability of 65% by the Veterans Administration to construct these cottages. This is the new prototype that they have put in place since the year 2010. It was implemented in 2011, and all across the nation, this is what they are now building, because we know this is the type of lifestyle. If you have to go to a long-term care facility, this is where you would want your parent, your loved one, to reside. It is the new way of taking care of our loved ones. So with that, and I think I should explain that there has been some confusion about the facility that we now have in the northern part of the state. It is a domiciliary facility, so it is just assisted living. We do not have there at that property a place for long-term care. So if they have an acute situation or they need to have medical attention, they need to have surgery or anything like that, they have to be transported. And typically they would be transported to our Veterans Hospital in Sheridan to be cared for. And we do have residency or long-term care there. They can move it back and forth within that Veterans Administration Hospital in Sheridan and also in Cheyenne. And then there's been the question about the number that is approved. And I think we're at, I have so many pieces of paper, but I think we have the availability of about 158
beds in the state of Wyoming that were approved by the federal government. I think it's 154, and we currently have about 116. So it allows us to expand by about 38. If we were to build three cottages in Sheridan with 12 units each, we would be able to fit within that requirement, and that would give us enough to get started and still not preempt the options to, in the future, build in Buffalo. What we have to keep in mind is if when you're working with the federal government and you're working with that loan and that process, the paperwork and the application, the grant work that's involved, is a long process because you have to get the congressional delegation involved. You have to go through the approval process. And so to even break ground, it's going to take us a while. So we really, in order to look at this concept and to start working on it, we need to start now in order to take advantage of this opportunity. And I think one of the proposals that I'll have for you tomorrow, I handed it out today because I really wanted you to look at it. We had great discussion in appropriations, and I really wanted to clear up what it would cost to build one of these facilities. So I have that breakdown, and you will have time to look at that this afternoon. Ask me questions, and then we can discuss it hopefully further tomorrow on that. This would be a loan from our permanent land fund, and I suggest that we would look at adding an interest rate of 3% on that. And the way this works is that the veteran receives a fund for long-term care, and then they also receive Medicaid and or private pay. So the way it works is you then facilitate the care by a nonprofit organization. They have a 12% fee typically to operate it. The state would own the building, but 65% of it would be paid by the federal government. 35% would be a loan that's paid back by the fee of the veterans' services. And you would, I hope, would be actually able to self-sustain, have a sinking fund to make certain in the future that we'd be able to maintain the building, because the last thing I would like to have is for the state to have an obligation of maintaining the building. And what I'd also like to have is an incentive for other communities to be able to build this type of facility across the state. And in working with the different groups that support veterans, we have identified probably 9 communities that could make this work. What's really important is you have to have close proximity. One that's important is a Veterans Administration Hospital is really ideal so that you're close in transportation needs and medical facilities. What I find ideal about sort of the northeastern region is that there would be not too much transportation involved. When you get people in this situation, this time of their life, the less that you have to move them, the better off we are. And, of course, we all know the better place for any of our loved ones is at home. But when we get them to a situation like this in their life, we then want to give them the best care possible. And I think that this new way of treating them in this type of long care, term care, is ideal for them. And this is a better way to be serving our vets. And what a great opportunity for us, since we don't even have a facility like this, to start out fresh. I've had several questions about facilities that we already have across the state of Wyoming. What I found out is because most of these facilities across the state of Wyoming were built in probably around 1965 timeframe, based on the prototypes and the requirements by the Veterans Administration, we are not able to adapt to fit with that model, and it wouldn't be cost effective for another facility that already exists in the state of Wyoming to fit with that. So that doesn't seem to be a conducive business model at this time for someone to come in, because that would be also the last thing I would want to do is to have the state or the federal government competing with our private sector on giving care. But so far, I haven't had anyone come to me with a proposal that would work with that. So that's basically the introduction to what this bill proposes. And then I do have a committee of the whole amendment, which I'm not quite ready to move yet And of course, I've lost it. Here it is. But I wanted to just work through part of it. So the first page of the bill, House Bill 216, is just creating that this is, and it is new terminology, by the way, a new skilled nursing center for veterans. And we include spouses and also have a provision there for non-veterans. Part of the other obligation, if we were to take federal funds at 65%, is that the cottage has to provide for up to 75% of the occupancy to be for veterans, and then the remaining 25% can be for non-veterans. And what I have read and have been told, and if you were to do more research, you would find that across the nation in most of these facilities that there is a waiting list for these properties. So again, there shouldn't be a problem in filling these cottages. When we go to page 2 of the bill, it just discusses who the veterans would be, and certainly we've had this discussion already in the last month about honorable discharge. When we get to page 3 with part of my committee of the whole amendment, it has to do with the qualifications of admissions, and so I will visit with you on that. And we had some archaic language in there and some residency requirements. I will clear that up for you on page 4 and on page 5. We've had discussions in both committees about the burial process. I will explain that in further detail for you. And we do have a on the bottom of page 5, it discusses the contractual day-to-day operations, which is a management that is not provided by the state or by the federal government. It is an actual service by a nonprofit or another organization that charges a management fee that is negotiated by the state. And then when we do that, the one requirement by the federal government, if we were to take advantage of this program, is that we have to provide one full-time employee on site to manage all of the paperwork. And I think we've all now been in the legislature long enough to know of the sort of the amount of paperwork that is required in doing the work of the government. So I think that's enough said there. And then it's necessary to have in there on page 6 the acceptance of donations. In the work that we're doing in my county, we have land donated for these cottages. And the state must own the land where we are to build. That's a requirement, again, by the federal government. And then on page 7, that is part of the process of going through the borrowing the money and using the funds from the permanent land fund. And another component of using the permanent land fund monies is there currently is about $46 million in that fund. And if I propose to you that we add a 3% interest rate on that, which through a few years of making payments would add revenue to the interest fund, then that those revenues can be used for our other state facilities by both the Department of Health and the Department of Family Services that have assets across the state of Wyoming. So that's one way for us to, you know, have a low interest rate, start a new program that we would own with a mere investment, but not have to be fully paying, because I think it's quite a value if we are able to get a facility to provide for 36 of our veterans across the state of Wyoming that would cost us more than $9 million, and our loan investment would be $3 million over, let's say, somewhere between 8 and 12 years. That's really quite a great way of serving our vets, I think. So that's on page 7. And then we actually just go through the duties and the powers on page 8. And then with all of our state facilities, there are certain things that are required to be available to our residents or the folks that are residents of our facilities. And that would be on page 9. And that in one particular situation, that's special fishing permits. They are allowed to go fishing, so that's a good thing. and establishing the state institution is on page 10. And then we will make some adjustments if this bill were to pass committee of the whole today on the second reading amendment that would show the proposal of the loan request on the bottom of section 4, the loan request, and the page 11, which would be the contingency fund that would be necessary. And again, the federal government matches 65% of the contingency fund for construction, which is very important to have if you're working on a facility of this size. And then on line 16 of page 11 is the one-time employee that would be necessary to start at the appropriate time when the facility is ready to start up and start admission of the veterans. And like with any new facility, it takes a while for them to build up the residency and to build up the revenue. So that's part of the startup cost up front that they have to borrow until they make enough revenue to start making back the loan payments on that. And that is the bill, basically. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would move the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 216 and just walk you through that quickly. Basically, we are changing on page 1, line 3, we delete the balance of the line after center as specified, and then we go to page 3, line 13, and we delete the balance of that line, and we add admission of non-veterans. So the reasoning there is because of, taking federal funds, we cannot identify all the specific rules there So if you go down, and this follows into line 20, what that would say now instead of 75% and 25%, and what those details were originally, it would say the persons are qualifying dependents or the parents of the United States military personnel who were killed in the line of duty as provided by the statute, rule, or regulation of the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. Then we go to page 4, we just delete lines 1 through 8. We do a new Romanet 2 on line 10. And lines 17 and 18 are deleted. And then over on page 5, lines 8 through 10, we had quite a bit of discussion about that in appropriations. And that we did some more research, and we are deleting that because that burial service is already being paid for and will be covered, so we do not need that language in there on that. And then on page, and I think that pretty much takes, and then just a renumbering with the Romanet on line 12 from Romanet 3 to Romanet 2. So that is the Committee of the Whole Amendment, and if there aren't any questions on that amendment, I would call for the question.
Chairman Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Trying to use this mic. I don't think that one works as well, but really my question on the Committee of the Whole Amendment is basically we've struck most of the provisions for veterans out of the bill, it seems like, on page 3 and 4. Talked about the 90% occupancy for veterans. That's struck. Flip over to on bottom of page 3, all of basically paragraph A. And then as you flip over to page 4, it's struck as well. All that language is struck out of there. And I guess, you know, I kind of go back to my original comments, Mr. Chairman. You know, this is an appropriation out of the Permanent Land Fund, which was not an appropriation count. This is It uses a loan out of that account. This account is $45 million, and it's a permanent fund, and it generates income. That is, it has about $2.5 million in the income fund. The income fund then goes into support facilities for health, for corrections, for DFS, those kind of things. But This is kind of, I don't recall ever doing this, I guess, taking a loan from this permanent fund, and then really the payback provisions, I guess, that, and that's was, we worked this bill hard in committee too. We spent a couple hours on this, and just really, there are really no solid payback provisions in it. It's kind of, and if you look at the fiscal note on page one and then look at the back of page two, the fiscal note where it talks about how much it's going to cost and then the projections of the revenue that it's going to create, it's a pretty thin margin. And so I don't know when this will be paid back. It doesn't say. There's no group like the Wyoming, I don't know if I'd say it on the floor, a business type entity that overlooks these kind of loans. There's no provision for that. And so as I listen to this, and then as the really all the provisions for veterans are struck out of this, I'm kind of wondering where this leaves the bill. And members, I say again, at the end of this budget, depending on your actions, we'll have close to $85 million in the bank for our state health facilities. Those are the ones in the Constitution that you all know about, where they're located along I-80, some of them along I-25, some in the basin. And we're going to have to make a lot of decisions on those. That cost is, according to the studies, you know, options 1A and 1B and so on. I mean, it's up there around $130, $40 million, and we're going to do that. I mean, and I think this is going to be a part of it. I think this greenhouse model will be a part of it. But, you know, usually these things come through A&I and through level 1 and 2 studies. And then we all look at it, and then we appropriate money for level 2 studies. And then knowing that once we hit level 2, we're probably in. And we can still hold back on the construction part, but once we kind of get down that road and we tee these things up, and they take years to get there. And I would just submit to you, I think this, none of us argue with the idea. I think that's the way this is going to happen in Wyoming. But I think where and how it gets paid for are things that we all have to decide on a bigger picture, I think, on how it fits into the whole scheme. I'm not arguing that there's not a need. There is a need. And I think it will happen. But I just don't think it should happen now in this bill. And so I'm against the amendment and against the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further debate on the amendment? Representative Biaggi?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think the previous speaker said everything that I had written down. The permanent land fund, what is it really used for, and do we borrow from that? I don't remember doing that. And the amount of interest created was just discussed, the percent we're getting versus the percent that is being asked for. So that was one of the concerns. And then the placement that the previous speaker. Working with the veterans in my county, whenever we need something and we need to go to Sheridan where the veterans is, that's a, you know, a big distance. And so we have the we can send, you know, x-rays and MRIs and so forth. But I'm wondering if placing it in this area versus something a little more centrally located, if we're starting a brand new concept with these pods and so forth. So I also wonder about the finances and the placement. Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to go back to the good chairman from appropriations, if you go back to line two, page two, that is the definition of the veterans. Page three was actually explaining the exceptions to who could be the other residents, the 25% in the facility. So this is all about qualified veterans in these cottages or in this new style of living, which is on page two. This is not excluding veterans. It's all about having qualified veterans in the facility. I would think that if you were going to start a new facility and you had this opportunity available, that we would be building more of them across the state. We have an existing infrastructure in place, so we have the availability to build the prototype now with a VA in its proximity to be able then to expand into other communities with all of the work done and having it available. Now, when it comes to the permanent land fund, it has $49 million in it. I would like to bring an amendment tomorrow to discuss the loan opportunity that we could provide. With the sheet that I handed out to you today, we should actually be able to pay it back within, I think it was eight years or less. You can increase that payment if you want on that, but it should definitely pay back. And then the state actually has a property that they already own with a sinking fund to be able to maintain it. So I think this is a great opportunity for us to be able to serve our vets long term and with minimal risk.
Any further?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would take a look at that handout, I did have that there for you to look at the estimates. These are actual costs for the cottages, what the projected revenue would be, and how it would play out. That's what appropriations asked for, to see how we could pay it back.
Any further debate on the amendment? Okay, question has been called on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1. All of those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Who opposed, say no. Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Now, is there any further debate on the, we're back on the bill. Is there any further debate on the bill? Representative Laux, are you wanting to speak?
As long as I have your permission to, sir.
You have my permission.
Okay. I like this bill. I mean, it looks like there's some things that need to be worked on it, but I mean, I see a couple things. It's a new concept. It's out of the box. And I know looking at the information we received, Arnett, that I'd sure like my loved ones in this compared to what the VA facilities are like right now. And then another part of it that's really crucial to it is the fact that basically I like the idea of private and public coming together, and we're not going to grow our number of state employees by this, where we would otherwise, most likely. This is going to be a project together with public and private, and I think that's a good thing and the way we should go with these projects. Thank you very much.
Representative Blake.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We had this concept brought to us before in Transportation Committee, and it is a good concept then, but we failed to do anything with it now. And I like this approach, as the previous speaker said. So I urge you to vote aye on this, and we'll bring another amendment maybe to work out the funding or whatever. But this is a good bill. It's good for our veterans, and it's the wave of the future. So please vote aye.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Folks, I'd just like to take a minute with you and share, reinforce some of the comments that our chairman from Appropriations brought. I served on the Facility Task Force Committee, and I just want to remind you that we had a study done that took over a year's time, cost about $500,000. The state looked at all of the state facilities, of which the Veterans Home in Buffalo is one of. Since our last legislative session, this task force met on a regular basis, sometimes on a monthly cycle, to look at these things and to kind of determine what we wanted to do with the state facilities in the state and how we move forward. We have five of them, one in Evanston, one in that throughout the state. And what is the purpose of these facilities and how are we going to move forward with them? Do we want to continue to have the state try and take care of the large population that these facilities have historically taken care of, or do we want to use it as a safety net? And basically what we've come down to and our recommendation is that we use these facilities for a safety net and that we don't try to grow the state institutions. Now, this greenhouse model is a wonderful model, and the presenter of the bill is exactly right. That's the direction we need to move when we talk about long-term care and skilled nursing facilities. But when the task force met in Buffalo and looked at our veterans home, where we already own Abadonza land there, more than adequate to put anything there that we need to, the recommendation that we come back was to, and I'll read you, the recommendation is to implement enterprise, the veterans home is to construct a new domiciliary, which is what we currently have, and a skilled nursing facility based around the greenhouse concept, and then keep the historic buildings and raise the remainder. Now, if we move forward with this bill, what you're doing, Ellen, as you look at it, is we're creating a new state institution. And if you look at page 2 of the bill, it talks about the Veterans Skilled Nursing Center is created for the care and treatment of, and then on page 10 on section 25 where it talks about the establishment of state institutions, the following state institutions are established, and we're going to add the Wyoming's Veterans Skilled Nursing Center. Our recommendation from the task force is that we would put this skilled nursing facility using the model, that greenhouse model, at the facility that currently exists. First estimates are is to do this work is going to be around $38 million at the Veterans Home. We've already started putting money aside for that, as our Appropriations Committee has mentioned. And we are moving forward with the idea of establishing that. I think that we need to be really careful that we don't unintentionally get the cart in front of the horse and go over here and establish a new facility and then try to have the funding generated in an unorthodox way. I think that we need to be careful that, and we do need to remember that in Sheridan, or where this facility would be located, there is a veterans hospital and there's a skilled nursing facility at that. It is not based on this greenhouse model, but there is a skilled nursing facility there to take care of those issues that a skilled nursing facility to take care of now. So I would just really caution you and encourage you to think about this. We're well on, we've got a path kind of already plowed, and we know the direction we're headed. We've made recommendations. I would really encourage this body to just stick with the plan that we adopted, and let's develop what we've recommended and then come back. So I would stand in opposition to this bill.
Chairman Lockhart.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask the last speaker from River location with the town behind it. Has that report of that select committee been made available to all of the legislators, or is it still in a work in progress? Because I may have gotten it and just didn't read it carefully, or I may not have gotten it and would like to have it.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I do believe that that was made available, and if it's not, it's on the Department of Health's website, and it's called the Facility Task Force findings, and it is available to anybody that'd like to read that.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Chairman. So, yes, that report, the Interim Task Force report on facilities was November 1, 2014, and the two comments from the previous speaker are the Veterans Home is to construct a new domiciliary level and skilled nursing facility based around the greenhouse concept, keep the historic buildings, and raise the remainder. And then the recommendation on the Pioneer Home is study the potential for privatization, long-term lease for the Pioneer Home. A previous speaker also said that they were looking at the cost at the current Veterans Home to be at about $35 million. The cost of providing a new state institution, if you want to call it that, for the cottages in my area for up to 36 residents to the state would be $3.2 million at a value of a little over $9 million that can be in place within a two-year period of time if approved by the Veterans Administration with a 65% reimbursement and a loan with what I believe would be a guarantee back to the state of Wyoming based on the rest of the legislation and moving forward. So I think it's a terrific opportunity for the people of Wyoming and the veterans of Wyoming to look at this. And I can tell you, ladies and gentlemen, based on the research that we have, we are going to need more beds than 36, many more beds, because we don't have any to start with based on the facilities that are going to be required moving forward. So this is just something that we need to consider. All we need today, obviously we don't have any money in this bill. We have the concept. We can move it forward. We have a lot of great minds in this room. We can come up with even a better budget amendment for second reading tomorrow or third reading to make you comfortable. But I think this is a terrific concept, and if you want, you can verify that this doesn't intercept with the task force that's at hand in working with the center that currently exists today. I have done that work over the last week with the committee work that I've had and the questions that were presented to me through the process. And I think this is a continuum of care based on what we currently provide today for our veterans, and I think the story only gets better.
Representative Nicholas.
I'm afraid to get up and speak on any bill at the moment right now, but I do have a couple questions. My understanding is that one of these homes was built in Sheridan and is currently operating. And just and I'm wondering, you know, how it's operating, what its costs are, whether or not it's viable. And that one is now, although it was, I believe initially government funded, is now being operated privately. But when this came to the committee, and if you see the handout, it says that we're going to get $500,000 a year. They're just numbers to me, and so there's nothing to really verify the accuracy of it. We didn't see any figures from any other new greenhouse constructions in other states, whether they've actually been to manage it at a proper level. And so there are just a lot of unanswered questions. And so if the good majority floor leader has additional information about how these operate, the 25 that are out there across the nation that you talk about, whether or not they actually make a profit and can grow, all those things, I think, are instrumental for us to spend roughly $9 million. That comes, you know, if you're in there as a couple, that's $520,000 a couple for these long-term care units. And so just to know that it's the best bang for the buck that we're doing, and all those things combined, and that, once again, that we don't have these units being the sixth arm of or facility for state government 10 years from now or 15 years from now. So there's those type of concerns. We just need to see the hard numbers to know that this is the right direction or not. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, on that question,
Representative Berger.
The breakdown on the VA per diem, for example, is 102, and the Medicaid that you can add to that, or private pay, but the Medicaid is 172, so that gives you a total of 274 per day. And the estimated daily cost is roughly 233, so that gives you a profit margin of about $41. And if you had 36 veterans, that gives you about almost $1,500 times 365 days, gives you about $539,000 a year positive cash flow. So that's based on discussion of an existing facility and how they're operating. I don't think you're going to get the exact figures from any facility because that's somewhat private in their business. But we know from the construction, 15% was added to the current construction cost based on the existing facilities that were built. So that's fairly accurate. And I think that the cost of doing business and serving the client is fairly close. So I can get more information, and maybe we could get some more information for tomorrow based on some other national facilities.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a little in response, folks, who the state has to build this facility in order to get reimbursement from the Veterans Administration. And that's why it can't be built privately. And so that's the idea behind having the state build it and then having a private entity run it. So when the good speaker of the bill talks about being reimbursed 65%, the state, wherever we build it, has the opportunity to get reimbursed 65%. There's no question that this model is the right model to do. However, the figures that are being presented here to build a facility as outlined in this bill, we don't have any drawings. Now, there may be drawings and blueprints from an existing facility that was built by a private entity, but we don't know that they're built according to the state codes, the state requirements. We don't have a document in our hand that can validate the costs that are being presented for this per-bed facility. We just don't have them. Now, those are estimates, and they may even be reasonable estimates, but that's all they are, is just estimates. And so I think it's, I think we have to be a little bit careful there because, and to get that done in 2 years, we have to remember that we have to appropriate the studies. We have to get the drawings and the work done and get that approved and then go into construction. Maybe. I think it'd be awful. I think it's going to be pretty difficult. There's a lot of work to do there because even though there is an existing model there, we would be starting from ground zero in designing and architectural studies, soil studies, and construction costs, getting a firm and all of those things in place. It might happen. I think the question is, wouldn't this be good to have several of these around the state? Well, perhaps. It really may. Let's get one built that we have planned, see how it works, and make some recommendations from there. Do we owe our vets? Absolutely. Do we have an obligation there? Absolutely. But we've already have a plan in place that we're working on. I think it's a very organized, with a very definite goal in sight, and I would encourage us to keep our eyes focused on that goal and to resist a deviation, if you will, from that. So, once again, I just caution you on your vote. I hate to be opposed to somebody that's as nice to me as the good presenter of the bill, but I just kind of have to on this one.
Any further debate? Representative Berger?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, back on the greenhouse model itself, that is how the existing facility that I'm speaking about has been built, based on a national model that has been approved by the Veterans Administration. Moving forward across the nation, it's the plans are how they built the facility currently. So, I mean, that is what they're promoting and requiring for the 65%. Requirement. And granted, ladies and gentlemen, I know that Wyoming is unique and we always have to add our signature to everything we do, so there may be some changes that we have to make. But I can tell you that I think that overall that we would stick pretty much to the blueprint that is in existence to today and that we have the prototype and the model working quite well already. So with that, I appreciate your indulgence, and I think it's been good debate, and we'll go from there, and I call for the question.
Question has been called. All those in favor of Representative Harvey's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill number 216 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no.
No.
House Bill 216 is passed Committee of the Whole. Next item. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 144. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 144 from the Education Committee, an act relating to school safety and security, establishing a comprehensive school safety program, requiring establishment of a tip line, requiring training, prohibiting disclosure of information, establishing supplemental financial assistance available to school districts for employing and training school resource officers for the protection and safety of schools, rulemaking authority for program administration requiring reporting and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, Committee Number 4, Education, to whom is referred House Bill 144, Education, School Safety and Security, respectfully report same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Those who voted aye, Representative Freeman, Northrop, Patton, Paxton, Piperinian, Summers, and Throne. Those who voted no, Representatives Hunt and Yeagy. Further reviewed by your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom is referred House Bill 144, the respectfully report same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Burkhardt, Connolly, Greer, Harshman, Moniz, and Stubson. One no vote, Representative Nicholas, signed by Representative Harshman, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Patton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 144 do pass. Explanation of this is in two parts, one part being with the Appropriations Committee and the second part to be with the Education Committee. I believe that perhaps the Appropriations Committee would be number one or no, number two.
I would yield
the floor to Representative Summers.
Have we acted on the Standing Committee Amendment number one from your committee? Oh, is he back? I'm sorry. Okay.
Representative Summers, if I might yield.
Representative Summers?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'll work the Standing Committee amendments in as I work the bill. Fellow members of the 63rd, I bring you House Bill 144, a committee bill, and I ask for your favorable consideration. In December 2012, the School Safety and Security Task Force was convened at the direction of the governor to study and provide insight on the status of school safety and security in Wyoming schools. The task force was comprised of 20 members of varying disciplines, and they concluded their work with a comprehensive report to the governor and legislative leadership on their findings in October 2013. With a focus on prevention in 2014, the Wyoming legislature increased the school safety responsibilities of the Wyoming Department of Education, the Office of Attorney General, and the Office of Homeland Security in a collaborative way through the introduction and passage of the budget bill in Section 336, which directed the formation of a school safety and security advisory committee representing multiple disciplines. The advisory committee, guided by the collaborative efforts of the Wyoming Department of Education, the Office of the Attorney General, and the Office of Homeland Security, was tasked by the legislature with multiple responsibilities, including the following: develop mechanisms for the establishment of collaborative safety teams within each school district, develop parameters pertaining to an anonymous reporting platform, and collaborate with school districts and law enforcement agencies and community representatives to develop guidelines for the use of school resource officers with an emphasis on a shared funding model. The advisory committee's recommendations built upon the findings of the School Safety and Security Task Force. The recommendations are a focused result of 2 years of research and discussion through the combined efforts of the task force and the advisory committee. The cover page for those recommendations is in your box with House District 20 on it. And actually, it's stapled together, and there's two pages. One's the cover page, and the other one I'll talk later. If anybody wants either of these reports, I have them. At the last interim committee meeting, the last interim meeting of the Joint Education Committee in Jackson, we received these recommendations and passed three motions for legislation. One, adopt a safe to tell strategy. Two, develop an SR program for districts without an SRO. And three, develop a partnership with Law Enforcement Academy for interested teachers and districts to send teachers through an SRO program. The House Education Committee's recommendation is the adoption of the safe to tell strategy. Standing Committee number one, eliminates sections 2 and 3 and parts of 4 and would leave the SRO discussion for the recalibration process. This amendment eliminates $3.3 million from the fiscal note, and I would stand for questions on the amendment.
Is there any questions by anyone on Standing Committee Amendment number 1? Seeing none, all in favor of Standing Committee Amendment number 1, please say aye. Opposed, say no. Motion's carried. The Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has passed the committee. Is there you want to proceed?
Please. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Representative Summers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Safe to Tell is recognized in Colorado as a proven model in preventing violence before it occurs. The Safe to Tell strategy accomplishes this through its three core components: education and awareness, prevention and early intervention, and accountability and follow-up. The Safe to Tell strategy would be administered by the Attorney General's Office within the Division of Criminal Investigation. The key elements of the Safe to Tell strategy are the information reporting platform and confidentiality protection. The Colorado experience suggests that law enforcement should shepherd the tip line. Safe to Tell is a strategic framework developed on principles of educating young people and school staff on critical issues, encouraging them to be part of the preventive solution, equipping them with a direct way to report anonymously, and empowering them to make a difference. The Safe to Tell strategy provides a unique bridge between communities, which focus on a collaborative prevention effort with support from multiple partners: justice, education, health, mental health, human services, and the youth who need help to avert an act of violence or injury. This relationship helps create and sustain a safe school climate and assists in developing an effective information gathering system. Safe to Tell trained call takers will be available 24 hours a day, 65 days a year in Wyoming, with phone line, website, mobile app, texting, all available for report submission. Each mode of communication is customized for Wyoming's needs and is designed to be user-friendly. I have also provided you with a summary of the tips from the Safe to Tell program in Colorado, and these are actual tips, not false calls. There is currently a WeTip program administered through the Department of Education, but the calls are routed through another state. The Safe to Tell program would supplant the WeTip program. Let me walk you through the bill, and then we will discuss the funding when we hear the amendment from Appropriations. I'm going to get a sip of water. So on page 1 of your bill, in section 1, we create 91641 through 91644. Go to page 2, 91641, the unit of school safety and security created. The unit is within the Division of Criminal Investigation of the Office of the Attorney General. 91642, duties of the deputy. The deputy shall direct all activities of the unit. That's in Romanet 2, serve as the state's representative on local and state and national organizations involved in school safety and security and related functions. Romanet 3, act as the state's authority on necessary components of school safety and security plans and serve as the state's liaison with local governmental entities. The deputy shall also assist these agencies. Romanet 4, administer the program. Romanet 5, provide public information and education concerning issues related to school safety and security. Romanet 6, promulgate rules and regulations as necessary. 91643, programs, duties and responsibilities of the programs. Subsection A, the unit of school safety and security shall establish and administer a comprehensive statewide school safety and security program, which shall, Romanet I, include methods of anonymous reporting. Romanet 2, ensure the identity of reporting parties remain unknown. Romanet 3, allow for disclosure of information to law enforcement officers, employees operating the program, and school district officials obtained from a reporting party who voluntarily discloses his identity and verifies that he is willing to be identified. Romanet 4, ensure that a reporting party's identity, which becomes known through any means other than voluntary disclosure, is not further disclosed. And 5, share necessary information with law enforcement and public safety agency or school district officials. 6 goes on to talk about training. Romanet 6, go to page 6. Romanet 7, provide educational material to schools. Then we go into 91644, which is confidentiality of material. Subsection A, all records are deemed not to be public record and shall remain confidential information. Subsection B, persons implementing or operating the program shall not be compelled to produce any materials obtained in relation to the operation of the program except by a motion of a criminal defendant to the court in which the offense is being tried. And the following procedure shall apply, and if you kind of trip down to Romanet 3, if the court finds the offer of proof sufficient, the court shall order a hearing in chambers and at the hearing allow the questioning of the persons implementing or operating the program or review of material obtained in operation of the program regarding the offer of proof made by the defendant and other pertinent evidence. In Romanet 4, evidence admissible pursuant to this section, the court shall make an order stating that evidence may be introduced by the defendant, which shall require redaction of the reporting party's identity and may include the nature of the questions to be permitted. And then subsection C, any material provided pursuant to court order under subsection B of this section shall be sealed and preserved in the record of the court. And then that's kind of the program. And then if you go on to the fiscal note, it's probably the easiest place to talk about the positions. And then we will go to the Appropriation Committee's amendment. But basically what this program purports to create, if you look about midway on the page 1 of 2 of the fiscal note under description of appropriations, you'll see a series of bullet points. And so if you take the first bullet point, control terminal salaries, 3 positions. This is 3 positions in a call-in center. And it's my understanding it's to be added to 7 positions that occur in the Department of Criminal Investigation. Those 7 positions would be trained in this as well, but they have a lot of other duties, not all of which I understand, I just learned of, but they currently have a series of duties. There'd be a program administrator, which is critical. That's the one that kind of really pushes the program. And then 2, the third bullet would be an outreach education administrator. And then if you go on down, appropriation of $225,000 is necessary for support services, necessary equipment, and the software for the Safe to Tell program. That's the program in a nutshell, and I'm going to turn over to Chairman Harshman what appropriations did.
Chairman Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members on, so this bill is really only about a 2-page bill now, so if you went through it, you'd draw lines from the first Standing Committee Amendment. House Education basically took 2 of the 3 programs out of it, and then so we're on this anonymous tip program. And currently, state of Wyoming has an anonymous tip program. It's operated at a state on the far west coast. And, that's all I better say. And then, but it's not very effective. And, it's not really, there's no follow up, there's no really anything. And so, kind of the newest thing on school safety is, you know, I don't even know if it's so much facilities as we saw most recently back east, but really the issue is that most kids know about this. You know, the one that kind of got everybody started south of here, there were kids who stayed home that day. And that's been over a dozen years ago because they knew about it. And in this new age, so why is it here in the Attorney General's office? And so what we learned in committee number 2 was that instead of trying to stand up a new call center, they already have this. They already have a call center there. and they have operators 24/7 dealing with issues that come in all around the country and into our state and throughout our state. And so that's how it was brought to us then, as a way to Homeland Security, the Department of Education, and the Attorney General's office, instead of kind of creating a brand new call center to do this program. Okay, so as we worked this bill, and we worked this bill hard, I would just tell you that in Agency 206, which is Department of Education, there's also a unit called School Safety and Security. And if you look on your bill on page 16, line 16, and you can see that we're creating a new unit called School Safety and Security in the Attorney General's office. And so, you know, all of us on appropriations first thought, well, why would we have two units in two different agencies called School Safety and Security? And so we asked a lot of questions, found out a little bit more how the money's spent. And so then when you look at paragraph C on page 17, that's on line 17 of page 17, and I tell you, I think this paragraph needed some clarification anyway. If you just read it as it is, it says the funds appropriated in subsection B shall be reduced by any unexpended funds appropriated in the Department of Education's session law, that's last year's budget, section 206, unit 1401. That's the school safety and security unit that I just referenced in the Department of Education. So this paragraph already says that any remaining funds shall be transferred from the department to the Attorney General to fund the operation of the unit of school safety and security. So I asked, I said, what do you think of this paragraph? And I think they thought that just this the current tip line money would transfer. Well, the more we dug into this, I think it was appropriate to transfer all the unexpended funds and the positions, frankly. And what we found out about in Agency 206, Department of Education, basically is they collect 48 one-page reports from our 48 school districts and send it on as part of the NCLB No Child Left Behind reporting on violent schools. It's not any really outreach with that or any of that. And this new program proposes a lot of outreach. And so we thought, why would we have two units and two separate agencies? So our proposal with this standing committee amendment, Mr. Chairman, is just simply move it all. Move it over here. We know everybody agrees that the current tip thing that we've been doing for years is not really effective. And if we're going to do this new program, let's not grow government. Let's shut this one down and move it over here. And so that's really what the amendment does, Mr. Chairman. And you'll see that on the first part of the amendment, members, on line 1 of the amendment and line 3 of the amendment, says, after shall, we insert not. And that just refers to that this will not be included in their standard budget. And we commonly do this in the legislature when we start something new because we don't want it to be rolled into the standard budget. We want them to come back and let's have a long discussion about this next winter when we're setting up another biennial budget. So that's why it's not that we didn't support the program or any of those things. It's just we simply want to have more conversation about this. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd stand for any questions.
You moved the amendment?
I've moved Standing Committee Amendment number 2. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any debate or remarks on Standing Committee Amendment number 2? Representative Somers, are you used to mic? Oh. All in favor of Standing Committee Amendment number 2, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That motion carried. We're back on the bill. Representative Somers.
Mr. Chairman, I want to say a few other things. One is, I believe there's likely to be a second reading amendment to further, I think, narrow down that body for this initial startup phase. So I think there will be another amendment coming that will just kind of shrink things a bit and let us get it stood up. The one thing that, and I have to admit it, that she's a really good salesperson. There was an attorney general, assistant attorney general out of Colorado that has given this presentation once to the education committee and once to the appropriation committee. And it's too bad that everybody in this body can't hear that presentation because she really talks about the successes they've had. And if you just look at that data report on that second page I gave you, you can kind of get an idea that the calls, you know, it starts out slow and then it picks up as people understand that it's available. And you can kind of see where the reports lie. A lot of the, the bulk of the reports are in bullying. The next biggest category is suicide interventions, drug and alcohol, threats of violence, sexually related crimes, and then it kind of rolls down. You know, obviously Colorado's a lot bigger than us. We won't have that volume. But I think it's a, I think the essence of this program is to try to provide a way to get students involved in helping make sure that their cohorts are safe. And I just want to relay one, you know, a story from my neck of the woods on this issue. In the last 2 years, the last, since I've been in the legislature, both years, there has been a suicide in our, of a school-age child, a K-12-age child in my county, one in each community. And one of them was my best friend's stepson. So I really believe that we need to take a hard look at how we can improve that suicide awareness and kind of all that it goes with, bullying. And I just think this is a way to give it a shot.
Senator Lindholm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Some things that kind of struck me as odd about this bill is there's children will be able to use, be able to call in and accuse other children of whatever they want. And in lots of cases, this could protect children. My concern is what happens to the bullies, those types that would just call in a false call and make some type of false accusation? At that point, the child that's being accused, they have no way to defend themselves. They have no way to face their accuser. They're guilty until proven innocent, which is kind of the opposite that I feel that we're trying to teach our children in school. Once again, innocent until proven guilty is the way we stand, and this bill seems to do the exact opposite. Thank you.
Representative Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This ended up being a very long discussion and debate in the Education Committee. And the result of it was that take Section 2 out, take Section 3 out, that several millions of dollars involved in that. And what would we want to do with what is now being the public interest of trying to protect the kids at school? That's what it really came down to. The anonymous tip line was the one that hit particularly the administration's nerves, being the Department of Education as well as the AG's office. They really were most cooperative one to another, and they really listened to the districts across the state. And one of the problems that you're faced with, and we were faced with, what can we do that has some application generally, some places more important than others, across the 48 districts? If you guys can come up with, or if ever anybody else can come up with a better idea that's going to translate somehow an implementation of some kind of a call system that is coordinated within each one of the counties, that's what we're after. That's what we're trying to do. Does this bill do everything right? Absolutely not. We just aren't that smart. 48 districts are so different. One district, as an example, has several security officers that rotate within the community in all of the schools in the community. They don't need something like this. They've already got it. They've got the coordination. They've got the phone. But there are other districts that have zero. So how do we do it? Well, this was the compromise that was available to us and was available largely because of the cooperation of the AG's office and the State Department of Education and Homeland Security. So if it needs more work and you want to do something with it that way, I guess we can try something else, but this was the best shot that we could come up with. Thank you very much.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To address the speaker before about anonymous tips and confronting the person who accuses you of something. Teachers deal with that every day. We get notes on our desks. We get somebody coming up and saying, I know that something bad's going to happen and it's going to come over there. The beauty of this bill is that the handling of the student is turned back over to the local authorities, whether it be the police, whether it be the counselors. The way that I understand how the whole thing operates is wherever it's appropriate, that's where the call will go. The nice thing about this program also is they don't let it hang with just by the notification. They also go back and say, what have you done? You know, how have you closed down this threat of suicide or this threat of bullying and that kind of stuff? What this does is it enhances programs that schools already have by giving them information to what they can act on.
Thank you. Any further debate on the bill? Chairman Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to reiterate, I don't think I did a very good job that by moving that agency 206 money, you know, there's $550,000 in recurring dollars in that unit. And they asked for on this was $410,000 at fully funded, which would double. So we offset about 75% of the cost of this program was our plan. And I, you know, we'll see how this progresses through the process, but it could maybe be trimmed up a little more. So I think we did our diligence on this one. I urge your support of the amendment and then the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're on the bill. The question being called, all those in favor of Representative Patton's motion to win the committee of the whole rises to report. It do so with the recommendation that Bill number 144 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Chair is in doubt. Would all the ayes stand up? All the ayes. Oh, jeez. They were quiet. House Bill 144 has passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 162. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 162 from Representative Wilson, an act relating to public health, creating the Provider Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment Program Act, providing for execution of health care treatment documents and orders as specified, requiring compliance with medical orders as specified, providing for civil and criminal immunity as specified, requiring rulemaking, providing for continued effectiveness of prior medical directives, repealing the cardiopulmonary resuscitation directive statutes, and providing for effective dates. Mr. Chairman, the Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom is referred House Bill 162, Providers Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment, respectfully report saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Connolly, Greer, Moniz, Nicholas, and Stubson. Those who voted no, Representatives Burkhart and Harshman, signed by Representative Harshman, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Harshman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee of the whole rises to report, I do so with a recommendation that House Bill 162 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the standing committee amendments. And, Mr. Chairman, we amended this bill pretty significantly, did a lot of good work on it, and this was a bill that was referred to our committee, not re-referred, and I would like our Mr. Speaker Pro Tem Stubson to take you through the standing committee amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just I'll try to do a cursory review, and then I know the good representative from Laramie County can give you more detail on the function of the bill. But the one of the concerns that the committee had, we have in our statute right now a provision for advanced health care directives, and many of you have probably used that. And it's where you go through and you can, it's a legal document, you go through, you determine how much care you want at the end of life. One of the problems with that is that it's not in your medical records typically. It's probably in your legal files at home. And so when you're actually undergoing treatment from physicians, they don't have that in front of you. And sometimes, oftentimes, it doesn't dictate care as it should. So this POLST program, while it is good at making sure that there is something in your medical records to carry out your wishes, we really had a concern and wanted to make sure that it worked with the Advanced Healthcare Directive and that the priorities of what governs when were more clearly spelled out. And so that's really what we have done with the amendment. And I'll walk you through a couple of the changes. On page five, you will see that it talks about the POLST form and what information should be included in it. We loosen up that language a little bit just to say to the extent possible it should include standards for end-of-life care. The big changes you will see starting on page 8. And in page 8, as the bill was originally written, it said that in the absence of a valid POLST form or other order, that it would be assumed that presumed that the individual's consent to life sustaining treatment existed. But we wanted to make clear that if you had an advanced health care directive, that would apply. So we included that if in the absence of a valid POLST medical record or an advanced health care directive available to the treating provider, only in that circumstance will the individual's consent to life sustaining treatment be presumed. On the next page, on page 9, this talks about what if the POLST contradicts with the advanced directive. And what we amended this section to basically say that the most recent document signed by the patient will prevail. And the reason we did that is because we wanted to make sure that you couldn't have somebody, a guardian, somebody like that come in, execute a POLST that contradicted an advanced directive that you had actually done. And so if you sign off on the POLST, it can override what's in an advanced directive, but only if you have signed off on the POLST. And then the other sort of big area of changes is found in the revocation on page 10 and 11. And you'll see in the bill that if you want to implement a POLST, you have to sign it and date it. Your physician has to sign it and date it. But as originally drafted, the bill said you could orally revoke a POLST. And we thought if you're going to revoke it, you should have some formalities just as you have when you execute it. And so now we've included that it can be revoked in writing, signed by the individual, or on page 11, in the case of a POLST that's executed by an agent, guardian, or surrogate, they can withdraw one that they have executed if they do so in writing signed by them. And so that's a quick run through on what we did. If you have any questions on the amendment, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'd move for adoption of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1.
Is there any debate on the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Winters.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to divide the amendment and make division number 1, lines 35, 6, 7, and 8, and the remainder of the amendment, division number 2.
So if I understand, you want line 35, 36, 37, and 38 to be division 1 and the balance division 2.
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, proceed on whichever one you want to deal with then, Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do like the work of the standing committee. There are a lot of details that they, I believe, fix very well. The issue that I have and that is dealt with in division number one, which is, of course, lines 35 through 38 of your amendment, are found on page number 10. And so if you would take a look at that, basically it changes the wording there on lines 19 through 21, which currently reads, an individual's consent to all or part of a post form may be revoked at any time and in any manner that communicates the individual's intent to revoke. In this particular case, what the Standing Committee Amendment would do is make it to where it has to be a writing in a writing signed by the individual. And here's the reason, the basic underlying reason why I would like to ask you to vote no against Standing Committee or this particular division, division number one of the Standing Committee Amendment. And it's because I believe that it would be best to always err on the side of life. And if an individual, even if they have signed a pulsed form in the past, if in any way that they can communicate that they wish to remain and they don't want to die, even if it means two blinks of an eyeball or a blink of an eyeball, whatever, if it's yes or no, however they want to say it, they ought to have the opportunity to intervene on their own behalf. And so if you force an individual to submit that in writing, if in some sad way they're not able to utilize their hands, their arms, something along those lines, and yet they can still communicate that they would rather live, I believe that it would be best to err on the side of life. And so for that reason, I would ask to strike those particular lines and ask you to vote no on division number one.
We're on division number one. Representative Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'd like to echo the comments of the last speaker, but also include that having just gone through this in December, with a family member, she was unable to sign anything due to a stroke. And so there are just situations where when they're cognizant, when they're able to speak, when they're able to communicate to the doctor, this is my wish, then that should be sufficient. But to make someone who is incapable of signing, and I can think of so many situations, you know, somebody that's been paralyzed, somebody, and I think that when your life situation changes, that you should be able to change your mind about the decision that you made when you were well and healthy. When you were well and healthy, you're going to go, well, yeah, I want to live, and yeah, I want to do this, and yeah, I want to do that. But then when you're faced with living a life trapped in a body that doesn't work, under a very painful situation, under a lot of different situations, I think that you should be able to make the decision to the doctor as to a change in your request for medical orders. And so I, too, am on and against Division 1 in the amendment.
Any further debate on Division Number 1? Chairman Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, too, had that same concerns when we worked this bill in our committee, and I think you'll probably find an answer from the good representative from the middle of the state. And I think it kind of goes in with paragraph B that's been amended, pretty well changed as well. So I guess I'd just tell the body, I mean, I had reservations on this, but there's more to this, I think, as we hear. And that was my same concerns as the good representative who divided this amendment, always err on the side of life. But more discussion, I think, to come on this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Speaker Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And a couple of issues. One, we did have this discussion in committee, and the testimony, or at least the discussion, was that there are mechanisms provided in the law that if you can't physically raise your hand and sign, there are still avenues for you to sign or authorize signature on a document. And we're not talking about you have to type it out and submit it. We're talking about if all you can do is scrawl it or have your agent scrawl a signature across the order, you can do that. And so we were satisfied that in a circumstance where you have a person that is able to indicate their will, you can accomplish it as written. The other real concern was the difficult
position that you put your health care providers in if you don't have something like this in there, if you don't have a writing signed by the patient, where you can imagine a situation where either support is given or withdrawn, contradictory to a written pulse that's signed by the patient, and then you have the family coming in and hammering on the healthcare provider afterwards saying, why on earth did you do that? We have a written pulse that says this is exactly what you're supposed to do, and Grandpa signed it. And the healthcare provider says, well, they blinked at me, and so I knew that they didn't want that done. I mean, that is an incredibly difficult position to put a healthcare provider in. And so part of our efforts in reworking this bill was to ensure that the duties, responsibilities, the obligations were clearly spelled out so you didn't have those situations where all of a sudden you have a healthcare provider that it's a he said, she said sort of argument that in these very, very important issues of life. You just don't want those situations. So we believe that having the writing requirement signed by the individual was a way that you could not only protect the patient and their family, but also the healthcare provider.
Any further debate on Division One? Representative Greer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think I want to kind of add to that because I was part of the committee that made these amendments. Whether you like this form or not, that's your decision to make. But I'll just tell you, the Standing Committee Amendment was geared towards if these forms are going to be passed by this body and codified, we wanted to make sure there was a crystal clear path so that we did not leave the healthcare providers in a lurch. And I think what was said by the last speaker was exactly correct, is that you didn't want to have this form in the chart that said, I want these life-sustaining procedures withheld, and then all of a sudden they do those without some indication, some verification. And you don't have to sit and sign your name. You can check the box, and there may be circumstances. But if that person's able to communicate, you can bring in a witness. You can go through that process. You can do that for any legal document. And so I'm not that concerned about it. And, again, whether you like the form or not, that's your decision. But I tell you, the Standing Committee Amendment made this a clear path so that there wasn't any confusion if these were in place. To keep in mind, as you go through this, you're looking at three different things that go on. One is a durable power of attorney for health care. The second are advanced directives. Those are documents usually prepared by your attorney. And then you've got this third document, this pulse, which is really supposed to be used when you have cancer or something where you know the end is near, and it's something you sit down with your doctor and your doctor has in their chart. And we took out anywhere where there would be a legal inconsistency with the Standing Committee Amendment and made that a smooth transition. So I would support this Standing Committee Amendment, both portions of it in whole, and then you make your own choice on what you want to do on the bill.
Anybody else want to weigh on, have any remarks on Division 1?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Winters.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate, again, all of the comments, and there were some very good issues that were brought up. But just by way of reference, the current language found in an advanced directive is the language that is found in the bill. And so the language found in the Standing Committee Amendment actually changes practice a little bit from what is already current practice. And so that's the reason why I think that however a person feels about the bill itself, I do think that the way it's written on page 10 of the bill itself is probably the best way to remain consistent, if that is the concern.
Any further remarks on Division Number 1 of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1? A question has been called. All those in favor of Division 1 of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, please say aye. Opposed, say no.
No.
Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has been defeated. Next, Division Number 1. Next item is Division 2. And is there any debate on Division 2? If question has been called on Division 2, all in favor of Division 2, say aye. Opposed, say no. That motion carried. Now we're back to Committee of the Whole Amendment for 162. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Friends, we've had sort of an interesting situation here. We've sort of discussed all the amendments before I ever got to explain the bill to you. But actually, I do have a Committee of the Whole amendment to the Standing Committee amendment, and that is really doesn't change anything that they did. It was just that you know how it is when you're in committee and you're parsing amendments on the fly. Sometimes there's just a few words that get out of order. So if you'll just look at it, I think I may as well go with the process. We're doing this from backwards to front as it is, I guess. So the Committee of the Whole amendment on, if you look on the bill, page 5, line 23, when they changed the wording to recognized standards for end-of-life care, they missed taking out an in. Similar thing on page 8, just got an extra D. It's an advanced directive, not an advanced. Mr. Chairman, I'm not actually quite sure. On page 10, the part that we just turned down had an amendment. So do I need to divide this amendment to take that part out, or is it just no longer relevant?
That the way I see that standing committee amendment number or division number one was defeated. Okay. So in my opinion, since it's now been defeated, deleting A is redundant. So there is no A. So I think I think we would have to divide the amendment to take care of line 7 and recommend that everybody vote no on division 1 if that's line 7. Representative Wilson?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Did you have a direction for me? I was receiving instructions back here. Do you want me to just skip that part? It's no longer relevant.
It's no longer relevant, and it is a committee of the whole amendment that deals with an irrelevant section of it, so I think you should divide the amendment for line 7, call that division 1, and tell everybody, all your friends, to vote no on it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just finish explaining. And then on page 11, this is just wording. It wasn't clear the way it was phrased, and so I have totally left the content but just rearranged the words in the sentence to make it a little bit more grammatical. So, Mr. Chairman, then I guess I would move to divide Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 into two parts and have lines 7 and 8 be part 1, and I urge your no, and then the rest of it be part 2, and I urge an aye.
Okay, you've heard the motion here. Division 1 is line 7 and 8. Recommendation is to vote no on it. All in favor of Division 1, say aye. Nobody. Say no.
No.
Division number 1 has failed. Now we're back to division number 2. Now we're ready for the question on that. Division number 2. Is all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. That has passed the Committee of the Whole. All right, now we're back on the bill. Is there anything you want to add to this?
Mr. Chairman, I'll just speak really briefly now because I think we've worked over this unknown bill quite sufficiently. The entire point, as was pointed out before, was that back in 2005, we updated our living will statutes with the Healthcare Decision Act, setting out the process for creating an advance directive, which, if you have one, and I all urge you to have one, is a legal document usually locked up in your safe deposit box. And as we know, nurses, EMTs, and so on cannot take orders off of legal documents locked in your safe deposit box. So the goal is to set up all over the state, providers and physicians talk to each other all the time now. This bill does not change anything at all as far as what their discussion is. It doesn't make any forms mandatory. All this bill does actually is provide a structure to have a standardized form for the state so that providers are not faced with different forms from around the state and from actually other states, because four of our neighbors have the same thing, and also makes it portable across providers so that if you are transferred from your home to a hospice or from nursing home to hospital and different providers, that it works, the patient's wishes are met in all the locations, and that is all we're trying to do. So I will just stand for questions there, I think.
Is there any further questions or debate on House Bill 162 or on the bill? Representative Winters. Excuse me. I see no further debate. Is there a call for the question? The question has been called. All those in favor of Representative Harshman's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill number 162 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 162 is passed Committee of the Whole. Next item, next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 50. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill number 50 from Representative Byrd, an act relating to food and drugs, providing a prohibition on the sale of cosmetics or personal care products containing microbeads, providing definitions, providing a penalty, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, of Committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred House Bill 50, Microbeads Prohibition, respectfully report saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Baldwin, Dayton, Harvey, Schwartz, and Wilson. Those who voted no, Representatives Barlow, Edmonds, Kasparik, and Larson, signed by Representative Harvey, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Harvey?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 50 do pass. There are no standing committee amendments, but there is a committee of the whole amendment. I will turn explanation of the bill to the sponsor and that Committee of the Whole amendment. He also sponsors Representative Byrd.
Representative Byrd, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the House, I bring you House Bill 50 today, Microbeads Prohibition. I think it would be easier in the discussion if I moved the Committee of the Whole amendment right now and like to so move the chair.
You want us to vote on it without at this point?
Yes, I'd like to move it so we can discuss it and I can integrate it into the bill. It will help the bill make more sense, Mr. Chairman.
Good. So you want to vote on it?
Well, I'd like to. Can I explain it? Can we proceed? I need a direction from the chair.
Well, it looks to me like it needs to be explained. It isn't just a correction. It's
yeah, that's what I'd like to do with the permission of the chair.
Good. Proceed.
Explain Thank the you, bill.
Explain the bill and explain the Committee of the Whole as it appears in the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Committee of the Whole amendment is from working with industry on this. And the if you grab your Committee of the Whole, it's fairly easy to track this into the bill. Basically, on page one, we change the word cosmetic to manufacturer, and then down in microbeads, we page one, line three, we insert microbeads. Line 114, after shall, we delete the balance of the line and carry that on to page two and delete those two lines over there on page two. And the rest of the amendment changes the effective dates that after discussions with the manufacturer's representatives, that these will be consistent with the other states that are implementing these bans. So they to act on that consistency, we would like to not be any more overburdening than the rest of the states that are going this direction. The industry, through their people, have advised me that those dates are good and they should be able to act within that period of time. Now, I call for the question on the Committee of the Whole amendment.
Any debate on the question of the Committee of the Whole? All in favor of the Committee of the Whole amendment number one, please say aye. Opposed? So, no. Motion carried. Proceed, Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, the rest of the bills. The history behind this bill is the microbeads. For those of you who don't know, there was a handout that came around earlier, a two-page handout, said HB 50 microbeads prohibition, had some text on the back. But if you didn't want to read the text, what you needed to do is turn to the second page and see the big, huge color picture of a piece of our currency with about 500 of these little things scattered on top of it. So you've got the actual size of what we're talking about here. These things are usually produced from petroleum or petroleum distillate products. So when they are introduced into water systems and domestic water systems and waterways, they do not degenerate on any rate like a natural substance. They have a shelf life that, because they are made out of a petroleum product, that is pretty far out there. So the problem is these particular little beads, because of the petroleum nature of them, they attract other amino acids and things in the water, and they build up a slime around them, which is ingested by the aquatic life. They also look like, if you look at the picture again, some of them look like the algae and the other things that the fish do feed on in the natural environment. So overall, from an aquatic species and wildlife management, this is extremely problematic because you have aquatic species that we'd like to use, like game fish and other things that we really do try to take care of in our headwaters, that will be in ingesting these things. At this particular time, they're having the area that's most affected is in the center of our country that borders on that other country to the north with those five lakes over there and their drainage systems there. They're finding significant deposits and significant parts of this inside their water supplies that are affecting not only their game species fish, but also domestic water supplies. If you look at the handout again, you know, I'm not going to go through it point by point. I would hope that you at least cruise through it. But some of the interesting things are more than 100 products that have this in them. And for all of you that are about my age, you remember the soap company that used to brag about the volcanic stuff that was in his soap that helped clean, you know, help you clean. And the primary use of this stuff is in exfoliants in soaps and toothpaste and shampoos and things like that. Some of the popular facial scrubs may contain as many as 300,000 microbeads in one container. So even though these things are small in size, the magnitude of the pollution is getting quite large. Skipping down to the bottom part in the handout, it says regulations. Right now there's two states that have adopted them. There's several other states that are in the process of adopting legislation similar to this. The federal legislation was proposed last year, but it didn't go anywhere in committee, so, you know, that's just an indictment of our federal government again at its best. So the industry, which the Committee of the Whole amendment had its genesis, is they're seeing that the public interest in this is rising as to have these things removed from their products. So the real response, you know, the real reason is this, is to put a fence line out there so that they know that they need to continue down this road and remove these things. Right now, they're under the initial, I guess what you say, research of, they're always researching new product formulations, but part of that is to remove these. In committee, when I presented this, there were a couple questions, and one of the questions is, had I talked to DEQ or Game and Fish? The responses that you see on here on this one handout are primarily from DEQ, and the interesting thing to take a look at is on the back of page one where it says major water treatment facilities. These are all cities in Wyoming that are either currently being, you know, most likely being affected in some way, shape, or form by this already, because these products are being sold within the state of Wyoming. So in case you didn't think that you had a dog in the fight, you might want to look at that list. It's quite interesting in its special way. So with that being said, there's only one other. The Game and Fish did comment on it there, that they're looking at it, they're interested in it, but they haven't done anything about it yet. So that takes care of the unanswered committee questions. We'll get to the bill, and I'll step through it if that pleases the chair.
It would.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Page one is we'll go through this rather quickly. It's an act relating to food and drugs providing a prohibition on the sale of microbeads. It's fairly straightforward. We're addressing Wyoming Statutes 357-128, adding a section in there about products, personal care products containing microbeads, and the prohibition starts in Section A, where the amendment kicks in there. We delete that line. Skipping down to on the back of page 2, 357-110, were the definitions. Because we don't have these in statute anywhere, we do need to define microbeads and what they are. They are micropolymer particles less than 5 millimeters in diameter. So it's a pretty specific thing that we're looking for here. Synthetic, semi-synthetic, polymetric materials such as polyethylene, polypropylene, polyethylene, and some other words that I can't pronounce too well, so you get the idea. We go down to Romanet XXII personal care products. We have a definition there that tells you what they're used in, what we're looking at, what the ban would include, a list of soaps, bar soaps, liquid soaps, body washes, lotions, primarily the things that they're in now that are in the sales in the stores. And so with that, again, reiterating that this bill was done and brought with you with consulting industry. They do support the bill in its present form with the dates pushed out there that we already approved in the Committee of the Whole. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I stand for questions.
Is there any remarks or questions on House Bill 50? Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question that I would have on this is, we've got in the amendment, we've got except for over-the-counter drugs. So I think that's an exception out of the bill for microbeads. And then some of the things described in this, polyethylene and polypropylene, I'm not sure I could find out overnight, though, but I think they're also found in some veterinary products, and I don't see veterinary products exempted out of it, and I'm not sure that they would affect the Great Lakes. So I'd ask that question if there's any exemption of other products besides over-the-counter drugs.
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the question. I am not a veterinarian. I am not a doctor. I'm just an old recycled geophysicist. So I do understand what these things are. I will go out on a limb and say the microbead formulation and the particle size is probably not the same formulation that would end up in a medical, in a pharmaceutical product or a veterinarian product. But I say that with a caveat that I am not one of those people. So, and that is the first time that that question's ever come up.
Any further remarks or debate on the bill? Representative Lindholm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question. Has any of these microbeads...
different
about that time of the day. any of these microbeads, have they proven to be hazardous? I mean, is there scientific proof killing fish from microbeads or any other animals?
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would ask the good bringer, does this bill include Kraft soaps and lotions that are sold privately or at craft fairs in our local communities? And secondly, who would enforce this?
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the two questions. There are some studies out there. There's also information from the other states who are ahead of us in putting the ban together. But in the interest of saving time and paper, I didn't print out those things and distribute them to you. The state of Illinois, or I should say, excuse me, the Lincoln State has some very in-depth studies that back their heading towards the ban, which involves their waters of the big lake that's called Gitche Gumee to the north, and the river that runs out of it with a namesake of one of their major cities. So there is some scientific investigation that backs this up. And as to the second question as to which agency would this come under, I believe it would probably be underneath the Department of Health. It could be very well under Game and Fish because of the waters, but I'm going to leave that to people who are much smarter than me to direct who would enforce this.
Any further debate? You ready for the question? Oh. Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A few questions on the definition of microbeads. One is it's less than 5 millimeters in diameter. That's 13/64. That's bigger than an eighth inch, which to me is out of the realm of micro. Additionally, it says micropolymer particles. Theoretically, you could get down to invisible particles that still qualify. So I need some more definition here because, you know, you sand on a piece of plastic, you could end up with particles. So I really need some more definitions.
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. These definitions are industry standard definitions that they use. In my chosen profession, we're able to measure things down to the nanometer. So I don't know if you want to include things divided down to that point. That would be an interesting second or third reading amendment. But as for this, I would rather stay with the industry standard definitions that are consistent across the other states that are heading towards this so that we have some uniformity so that the industry knows what they need to do.
Any further remarks or debate? You ready for the question? Okay, question being called. All those in favor of Representative Harvey's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 50 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Division? I can't tell which is which here. All the ayes, please stand up. All the noes? All the noes. And that would be me, too. Having failed a standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. The chief clerk will call the roll.
Allen. Baker. Baldwin. Barlow. Berger. Blackburn. Blake. Blake excused. Burkhart. Bird.
Aye.
Campbell.
No.
Kennedy.
Aye.
Clem.
No.
Connolly.
Aye.
Dayton.
Aye.
Edmonds.
No.
Edwards.
No.
Eklund.
No.
Esquivel.
Aye.
Freeman.
Aye.
Gay.
No.
Greer.
No.
Halverson.
No.
Harshman.
Aye.
Harvey.
Aye.
Hunt.
No.
Yagi.
No.
Jennings. Kasparik. Kirkbride. Croker. Crone. Larson Lloyd. Larson Dan. Lindholm. Lockhart. Lockhart. Lauchs. Madden. McKim. Miller. Moniz. Moniz excused. Nicholas. Northrup. Patton. Paxton.
Aye.
Pelkey.
Aye.
Petroff.
Aye.
Pipirinen.
Aye.
Pinnell.
No.
Reeder.
No.
Schwartz.
Aye.
Summers.
No.
Steinmetz.
No.
Stubson.
No.
Throne.
Aye.
Walters.
No.
Wilson.
Aye.
Winters.
No.
Swanitzer Dan.
Aye.
Swanitzer Dave.
No.
Mr. Speaker. I am about to close the vote. Are there any changes? Are there any changes? The vote is closed. 23 aye, 35 no, 2 excused.
Pursuant to House Rule 6-6B, House Bill 50, having failed, a roll call vote is indefinitely postponed. Next item on our next bill for our consideration is House Bill 220. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 220 from Representative Kasparik. An act relating to motor vehicle license plates, authorizing distinctive Wyoming coal license plates, providing for fees as specified, providing for termination of the issuance of the distinctive plates, and report of the termination as specified, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, your committee number A, Transportation, Highways, Military Affairs, to whom is referred House Bill 220, Wyoming Coal Specialty License Plate, respectfully report saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Allen, Blake, Campbell, Kennedy, and Eklund. Those who voted no, Representative Lauchs, Reeder, Walters, and Aves Wanitzer, signed by Representative Blake, Vice Chairman. Further reviewed by your committee number two, who respectfully report saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do not pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Burkhardt, Conley, Greer, Nicholas, and Stubson. Two no votes, Representative Harshman and Moniz, signed by Representative Harshman, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Zwanisser?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 220 do pass. There are no standing committee amendments. There is a Committee of the Whole amendment. But for the explanation of the bill, I will turn it over to Representative Kasparik.
Representative Kasparik.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm really excited to present this bill. This is the best bill of the day. Wyoming Coal Specialty License Plate comes to you cost neutral, with the support of over 900 of those people who use that book of faces on the internet, supported by municipalities in the northeastern corner of the state. This is a good bill. I appreciate and respect why some may be opposed to this bill, but I'm offering why it's good, and this is the right thing to do. This bill will promote the use and awareness of a Wyoming resource that has been embattled and battered by the federal overregulation and federal agency action for several years. The largest coal producer is this state, and its contributions to the state have been many and varied. Wyoming coal miners contribute $1.16 billion to the state in 2013, and they also support local revenues. The people who monitor our highways reported that they're used to these type of bills and they can handle it. Best of all, the bill will cost nothing. And an individual has come forward with a donation for the cost of creating the template, and the department that creates these templates believe that this is an absolutely okay thing and would allow it. So I'm asking this body to support the heritage of almost 200 years of mining, coal mining in Wyoming. It's our heritage, it's our history. The employees are 6,500 plus, families, spouses, other businesses like the cars on the rails that carry it, the businesses that support it with shovels. And I'm asking this body to allow those people to show pride in their industry, show support for their industry, and support for an industry that has been good to us.
Representative Croker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Somewhere there's a Norwegian wanting to speak against this bill, so I'll do it for him. I'm a big supporter of coal, and I think we all are, but I don't think we need any more license plates. If we had one for coal, then what's the next industry that's going to line up, and the one after that, and the one after that? So I would just ask you to consider that and resist this bill. We can support coal in many other ways besides creating a new license plate.
Any further remarks? Any further debate? Oh, Chairman Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and for the bill. You know, this industry supports that fine institute over the hill that we're all very proud of, and they have their own license plate. So I think the people that make the money deserve their own license plate. On and for the bill.
Chairman Wanasser.
Thank you, Chairman Madden. As you know, it came out of our committee with a split vote, but the only thing I want to call your attention to, the design of this license plates is going to be a little different than the others that we've had come out. And there is a handout that the fine representative put out on it. And if you look down in the bottom right-hand corner, that's where they're proposing to put their sticker, which is a little different than the other license plates that we've had that come out. Be aware that in the law in Chapter 31.4.101, there is a law against altering a license plate, and the only fear that I have, even though this will be printed onto your license plate, that other people might think that all of a sudden they can kind of start sticking whichever sticker they want there, and that may be good or bad. We can run as many of these through that you'd like, but I just wanted to call the body's attention to that.
Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to defer to my colleague over here, though. I believe we have a Committee of the Whole amendment.
Representative Kasperi.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The good Chair of Transportation reminded me of that with his comments. And that leads us to the Committee of the Whole amendment, which on page 2, lines 15 and page 2, line 16, and page 2, line 17, deletes a statement that that gives direction on how to design the bill and not to use Arabic numerals. I guess I would say that I leave the design of this template up to the department and in using their best discretion in creating a license plate that will meet their specifications and create no hardships on the department. Thank you. With that, I would call for the question on the House Standing Amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Question's been called on the Committee of the Whole Amendment. All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment number one, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Motion's carried. Now we're back on the bill. Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Coal power is 40% of our electricity here in America. And there is an attack on coal today. In fact, our president has instituted policies that has cut, really had an impact on our coal industry, saying it's the right thing to do. And it's not the right thing to do. Part of the appeal to this right here is it allows us to be proud of our industry. It allows us to push back and say, you know what, coal powers your fancy green cars, and it powers your laptops and your cell phones and the lights and all those kind of things. And so, really, this license plate is more, I guess, than it is something to be proud of for Wyoming. But then again, it pushes back against the attack on coal. And so I would say let's pass this thing because it's the right thing to do.
Any other remarks or debate on the bill? Ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Zwanister's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with recommendation of Bill number 220 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no.
No.
Committee of the House Bill 220 has failed the Committee of the Whole. Division's been called. All those that voted in favor, please stand up. Do you have to have the others?
Yeah.
Stand up, please. And that'd be me, too. Having failed a standing division roll call vote, a roll call vote is required. The chief clerk will call the roll.
Allen.
Aye.
Baker.
No.
Baldwin.
No.
Barlow.
Aye.
Berger.
Aye.
Blackburn.
No.
Blake excused. Burkhart.
No.
Byrd.
No.
Campbell.
Aye.
Kennedy.
Aye.
Clem. Connolly,
no.
Dayton,
no.
Edmonds,
aye.
Edmonds,
aye.
Edwards,
aye.
Eklund,
no.
Esquivel,
no.
Freeman,
no.
Gay,
aye.
Greer,
no.
Halverson,
aye.
Harshman,
aye.
Harvey,
aye.
Hunt,
no.
Yagi, Jennings, Kasparik, Kirkbride,
no.
Croker,
no.
Crone,
no.
Larson Lloyd,
no.
Larson Dan,
no.
Lindholm,
aye.
Lockhart,
aye.
Laux.
No.
Madden.
No.
McKim.
No.
Miller.
Aye.
Moniz excused. Nicholas.
No.
Northrup.
No.
Patton.
No.
Paxton.
No.
Pelkey.
No.
Petroff.
No.
Piperinen.
No.
Pinnell.
Aye.
Reeder.
No.
Schwartz.
No.
Summers.
Aye.
Steinmetz.
No.
Stubson.
No.
Throne.
Aye.
Walters.
No.
Wilson.
No.
Winters.
No.
Swanitzer Dan.
No.
Swanitzer Dave.
No.
Swanitzer Dave.
No.
Mr. Speaker.
Aye.
I am about to close the vote. Are there any changes? Are there any changes? The vote is closed. 21 aye, 37 no, 2 excused.
Pursuant to House Rule 6.6B, House Bill 220, having failed a roll call vote, is indefinitely postponed. Madam Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
Okay, you heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion's. The Committee of the Whole is done.
The clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. Speaker, the Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg to leave report as follows. House Bill 205, recommended do pass. House Bill 222, amended, recommended do pass. Representative Berger, move that the House rise and sit again. House Bill 231, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 208, amended, and further amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 216, amended, and further amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 144, amended, and further amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 162, amended, and further amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 50, amended. Following a failed roll call vote, the bill is deemed indefinitely postponed. House Bill 220, amended. Following a failed roll call vote, the bill is deemed indefinitely postponed. And it is signed by Representative Madden, Chairman.
Representative Madden. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Congratulations, Chairman Madden. Messages from the Senate.
Message number 202, Mr. Speaker. The bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 121, Career and Technical Training Grants, Ayes 18, Noes 12, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 203, Mr. Speaker. The bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 122, Vision 2020, Ayes 25, Noes 5, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 204, Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 134, Bighorn Sheep Plan, Ayes 26, Noes 4, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 205, Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading in amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 136, Expedited EMT Licensing, Ayes 29, Noes 1, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 206, Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading in amended form as the vote indicated. Senate File 138, Small Business Innovation Research Matching Funds, Ayes 18, Noes 12, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 207. Mr. Speaker, the Senate adopted the Committee of the Whole report, failing the bill listed below by the vote indicated. Senate File 128, Election Runoffs, Ayes 10, Noes 20. This bill is indefinitely postponed. Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 208. Mr. Speaker, the Senate adopted the Committee of the Whole report, failing the bill listed below by the vote indicated. House Bill 12, Game and Fish Violations-Restitutions, Ayes 12, Noes 18. This bill has been indefinitely postponed. Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 13, Method of Execution-1, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representative Halverson, Croker, Crone, Miller, Pinnell. For those who voted no, Representatives Baker, Escobel, Pelkey, and Winters, signed by Representative Miller, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 16, Engrossed Controlled Substances, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with following amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Baker, Escobel, Halverson, Crows, Pinnell, Winters. Those who voted no, Croker, Miller, and Pelkey, signed by Representative Miller, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred Senate File 49, Engrossed Initiative and Referendum-Revisions, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Blackburn, Byrd, Edwards, Gay, Jennings, Kirkbride, Lindholm, Paxton, and Danswanitzer, signed by Danswanitzer, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred Senate File 53, Engrossed Special Elections-Time Limits, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Blackburn, Byrd, Edwards, Gay, Jennings, Kirkbride, Lindholm, Paxton, and Danswanitzer, signed by Representative Danswanitzer, Chairman.
Three referrals. Chairman Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would like to re-refer Senate File 36 to Committee Number 7, Corporations.
Senate File 36 is re-referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations. Committee announcements. Chairman Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. You're Committee Number 4, Judiciary, right? Education will meet immediately after adjournment today, and on Wednesday, Senate File 10, Education Administration, will be right after adjournment on Wednesday.
Chairman Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Committee Number 1 will meet Tuesday, February 10th, upon noon recess in Room H8 to consider the following bills. Senate File 12, Trespassing to Collect Data, and Senate File 38, Controlled Substances, First Offense for Possession.
Chairman Zwanzer, Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, will meet tomorrow night, 10 minutes after adjournment, in H-17, to hear Senate File 30, Engrossed, Camp Guernsey Range Management Fund, Senate File 27, Vietnam Veterans Welcome Home Highway, and Senate File 81, Engrossed, Kevin's Law.
Chairman Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, will meet Tuesday, February 10th at 9 a.m. in Room 204 to hear re-referred bills, Senate File 5, Engrossed Quebec 1 Historic Site, Senate File 26, Challenge Loan Interest Rate. Thank you.
Chairman Zwana Serdan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, will meet upon noon recess tomorrow in H-18, to hear Senate File 37, State Protection of Data Privacy, Senate File 45, Digital Information Privacy Task Force, and if time permits, Senate File 33, Precinct Committee Person Elections.
Chairman Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet in 10 minutes in room H17, where we will consider Senate File 32, Small Employer Group Health Insurance, and Senate File 64, Wyoming Health Insurance Pool Act Extension.
Chairman McKim.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 5, Agriculture, will meet tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. to hear a presentation on pesticide safety. And also at 9:30, we will hear some testimony on the dry bean research, which is Senate File number 4.
Representative Freeman.
Privilege of the floor.
Yes, please proceed.
Representative Blake invites you all to come to the Wyoming Equality Reception at 8 o'clock tonight at 1901. It is the second annual House versus Senate karaoke. We have the trophy. Hopefully those of you, unlike me, who can only carry a tune in a bucket will show up and we trounce the geezers down the hall.
Lastly, ladies and gentlemen, I've been asked to announce that the reading clerk will be signing autographs out in the atrium 10 minutes after adjournment. Madam Majority Floor Leader, that clears the deck. Really clears it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, may I have privilege of the floor?
Yes, please.
Before we start with formalities, I'd like to thank all of my members for the hard work that you've done in the last 20 days. You've done the heavy lifting, and you've done it with respect, and I want to thank you for that. So give yourselves a hand. And, of course, the work never stops, Mr. Speaker. So your general file for tomorrow, February 10th, will be Senate bills. Senate File 22, 53, 49, 16, and 13. And again, that will be Senate File 22, 53, 49, 16, and 13. And with that, Mr. Speaker, I move that the House adjourn until 10 a.m. tomorrow, February 10th, 2015.
You've heard the motion. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. We're adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow.